Tales of the Unexpected by Roald Dahl. Taste, read by Geoffrey Palmer.
There were six of us to dinner that night at Mike Scofield's house in London. Mike and his wife and daughter, my wife and I, and a man called Richard Pratt. Richard Pratt was a famous gourmet. He was president of a small society known as the Epicures, and each month he circulated privately to its members a pamphlet on food and wines. He refused to smoke for fear of harming his palate, and when discussing wine he had a curious, rather droll habit of referring to it as though it were a living being. A prudent wine, he would say, or a good-humoured wine, benevolent and cheerful. I had been to dinner at Mike's twice before when Richard Pratt was there, and as we sat down I remembered that on his previous visits Mike had played a little betting game with him over the claret, challenging him to name its breed and its vintage. Mike had then bet him a case of the wine in question that he could not do it. Pratt had accepted, and had won. Tonight, I felt sure that the little game would be played over again, for Mike was quite willing to lose a bet in order to prove that his wine was good enough to be recognised. Mike Scofield was an amiable middle-aged man, but he was a stockbroker. Or, to be precise, he was a jobber in the stock market. And like a number of his kind, he seemed to be somewhat embarrassed to find that he had made so much money with so slight a talent. In his heart, he knew that he was not really much more than a bookmaker, and he knew that his friends knew it too. So he was seeking now to become a man of culture, and cultivate a literary and aesthetic taste, to collect paintings, music, and all the rest of it. Wine was part of this thing, this culture that he sought. The meal began with whitebait and a moselle. Mike was watching Richard Pratt, but he was completely engrossed in conversation with Mike's 18-year-old daughter, Louise. As he spoke, he leaned closer and closer to her, seeming in his eagerness almost to impinge upon her, and the poor girl leaned as far as she could away from him, nodding politely, rather desperately, looking not at his face, but at the topmost button of his dinner jacket. We finished our fish, and the maid came forward with the second course. This was a large roast of beef. "Now," Mike said, speaking to all of us, but looking at Richard Pratt, "I must go and fetch the claret, if you'll excuse me." "Fetch it, Mike," I said. "Where is it?" "In my study, with the cork out, breathing." "Why the study?" "It's the best place in the house. Richard helped me choose it last time he was here." At the sound of his name, Pratt looked round. "That's right, isn't it?" Mike said. "Yes," Pratt answered. "That's right." "On top of the green filing cabinet in my study," Mike said. "That's the place we chose. A good draught-free spot in a room with an even temperature." He hurried out of the door, to return a minute later holding a wine basket in which a dark bottle lay. The label was out of sight, facing downwards. "Now, what about this one, Richard? You'll never name this one, not in 100 years. A claret?" Richard Pratt asked, condescending. "Of course." "I assume, then, that it's from one of the smaller vineyards." "Maybe it is, Richard, and then again maybe it isn't. But it's a good year. One of the great years." "Yes, I guarantee that." "Then, it shouldn't be too difficult," Richard Pratt said, looking exceedingly bored. Except that, to me, there was something strange about his boredom. Between the eyes, a shadow of something evil, and in his bearing, an intentness that gave me a faint sense of uneasiness as I watched him.
"This one is really rather difficult," Mike said. "I won't force you to bet on this one." "Indeed? And why not?"
Again the slow arching of the brows, the cool, intent look.
"Because it's difficult."
"I'm perfectly willing to bet," Richard Pratt said.
All right, then. We'll have the usual, the case of the wine itself. You don't think I'll be able to name it, do you?
As a matter of fact, and with all due respect, I don't, Mike said. He was making some effort to remain polite, but Pratt was not bothering overmuch to conceal his contempt for the whole proceeding. And yet, curiously, his next question seemed to betray a certain interest.
Would you like to increase the bet? No, Richard. Case is plenty. Would you like to bet 50 cases?
That'd be silly. Mike stood very still behind his chair at the head of the table, carefully holding the bottle in its ridiculous wicker basket. There was a trace of whiteness around his nostrils now, and his mouth was shut, very tight.
So, you don't want to increase the bet?
As far as I'm concerned, old man, I don't give a damn, Mike said. I'll bet you anything you like. The three women and I sat quietly, watching the two men.
So, you say I can name the bet? Pratt asked.
That's what I said. There was a pause, while Pratt looked slowly round the table, first at me, then at the three women, each in turn. He appeared to be reminding us that we were witness to the offer. I noticed the maid standing in the background holding a dish of vegetables, wondering whether to come forward with them or not.
All right, then, Pratt said. I'll tell you what I want you to bet. I want you to bet me the hand of your daughter in marriage.
Louise Schofield gave a jump.
Hey, she cried, that's not funny. Look here, Daddy, that's not funny at all.
It's ridiculous, Mike said.
You said you'd bet anything I liked.
I meant money.
You didn't say money. But anyway, if you wish to go back on your offer, that's quite all right with me.
It's not a question of going back on my offer, old man. It's a no bet anyway, because you can't match the stake. You yourself don't happen to have a daughter to put up against mine in case you lose. And if you had, I wouldn't want to marry her.
I'm glad of that, dear, his wife said. I'll put up anything you like, Pratt announced. How about both my houses?
Mike looked over at his daughter.
You know, Louise, we ought to think about this a bit.
Stop it, Daddy. I refuse even to listen to you.
Just wait a moment and hear what I have to say. If Richard loses, he will have to hand over a considerable amount of property. The point is this. He cannot possibly win.
He seems to think he can.
I know what I'm talking about. The expert, when tasting a claret, so long as it's not one of the famous great wines like Lafitte or Latour, can only get a certain way towards naming the vineyard. He can, of course, tell you the Bordeaux district from which the wine comes, whether it is from Saint-Emilion, Pomerol, Grave, or Médoc, but then each district has several communes, little counties, and each county has many, many small vineyards. It's impossible for a man to differentiate between them all by taste and smell alone. I don't mind telling you that this is wine from a small vineyard that is surrounded by many other small vineyards, and he'll never get it. It's impossible.
You can't be sure of that, his daughter said. You can't lose. I guarantee it. What do you say, Louise? All right?
She hesitated. Then she gave a helpless little shrug of the shoulders and said,
Oh, all right, then. Just so long as you swear there's no danger of losing.
Good, Mike cried. That's fine.
Then it's a bet.
Yes, Richard Pratt said, looking at the girl. It's a bet.
Immediately, Mike picked up the wine, tipped the first thimbleful into his own glass, then skipped excitedly around the table, filling up the others. Now everyone was watching Richard Pratt. Slowly he lifted the glass to his nose. He swirled the wine gently around in the glass to receive the bouquet. His concentration was intense. For at least a minute,
The smelling process continued. Then, without opening his eyes or moving his head, Pratt lowered the glass to his mouth and tipped in almost half the contents.
"'Mmm,' he said, putting down the glass, running a pink tongue over his lips. "'Mmm, yes. A very interesting little wine, gentle and gracious, almost feminine in the aftertaste.'
There was an excess of saliva in his mouth, and as he spoke, he spat an occasional bright speck of it onto the table.
"'Now we can start to eliminate,' he said. "'You will pardon me for doing this very carefully, but there is much at stake.'
He looked up at Mike and smiled a wet-lipped smile. Mike did not smile back.
"'First, then, which district in Bordeaux does this wine come from? Oh, that's not too difficult to guess. It is far too light in the body to be either Saint-Emilion or Grave. It is obviously a Medoc. There's no doubt about that. Now, from which commune in Medoc does it come? That also, by elimination, should not be too difficult to decide. Margaux? No, it can't be a Margaux. It has not the violent bouquet of a Margaux. Pauillac? No, it can't be Pauillac either. It's too tender, too gentle and wistful for Pauillac. Pauillac has a character that is almost imperious in its taste. This is a very gentle wine, demure and bashful in the first taste, emerging shyly but quite graciously in the second, teasing the tongue with a trace, just a trace, of tannin. Then in the aftertaste, delightful, consoling and feminine with a certain generous quality that one associates only with the wines of the commune of Saint Julien. Unmistakably, this is a Saint Julien.
He leaned back in his chair, held his hands up level with his chest, and placed the fingertips carefully together. He was becoming ridiculously pompous. But I thought that some of it was deliberate, simply to mock his host. I found myself waiting rather tensely for him to go on. Louise was lighting a cigarette. Pratt heard the match strike, and he turned to her, flaring suddenly with real anger.
"Please," he said, "please don't do that. It's a disgusting habit to smoke at table."
She looked up at him, still holding the burning match in one hand, the big, slow eyes settling on his face, resting there a moment, moving away again, slow and contemptuous. She blew out the match, but continued to hold the unlighted cigarette in her fingers.
"I'm sorry, my dear," Pratt said, "but I simply cannot have smoking at table. Now, let me see. This wine is from Bordeaux, from the commune of Saint Julien, in the district of Medoc. So far, so good. But now we come to the more difficult part, the name of the vineyard itself. For in Saint Julien there are many vineyards, as our host so rightly remarked earlier on. There is often not much difference between the wine of one and the wine of another. But we shall see."
He paused again, closing his eyes.
"I'm trying to establish the growth," he said. "If I can do that, it'll be half the battle."
He picked up his glass and took another small sip.
"Yes," he said, sucking his lips. "It is a fourth growth, I'm sure of it. Good. Now we are closing in. What are the fourth growth vineyards in the commune of Saint Julien?"
Again he paused, took up his glass. I saw the tongue shoot out, pink and narrow, the tip of it dipping into the wine, withdrawing swiftly again. A repulsive sight. When he lowered the glass, his eyes remained closed, the face concentrated, only the lips moving, sliding over each other like two pieces of wet, spongy rubber.
"Tannin in the middle taste, yes, of course. Now I have it. The wine comes from one of those small vineyards around Bechevel. I remember now. The Bechevel district. And the river and the little harbour that has silted up so that the wine ships can no longer use it. Bechevel. Could it actually be a Bechamel itself?
No, I don't think so.
Chateau Talbot? Wait a moment.
He sipped the wine again, and out of the corner of my eye I noticed Mike Schofield was leaning farther and farther forward over the table, his mouth slightly open, his small eyes fixed upon Richard Pratt.
No, I was wrong. This is not a Talbot. If it is a 34, which I believe it is, then it couldn't be a Talbot. It's not a Bechamel, and it's not a Talbot, and yet it is so close to both of them.
He hesitated, and we waited, watching his face. Everyone, even Mike's wife, was watching him now. I heard the maid put down the dish of vegetables on the sideboard behind me, gently, so as not to disturb the silence.
"Ah!" he cried. "I have it. This is the little chateau Branier Ducru."
Mike sat tight, not moving.
"And the year 1934.
We all looked at Mike, waiting for him to turn the bottle round in its basket and show the label.
"Is that your final answer?"
Mike said.
"Yes, I think so." "Well, is it? Or isn't it?"
"Yes, it is."
"Come on, Daddy," the girl said. "Turn it round and let's have a peek. I want my two houses."
"Just a minute," Mike said. "Wait just a minute." He was sitting very quiet, bewildered-looking, and his face was becoming puffy and pale, as though all the force was draining slowly out of him.
"Michael!"
His wife called sharply from the other end of the table. "What's the matter?
Keep out of this, Margaret, will you please?" "Daddy!" the daughter cried, agonized. "Daddy, you don't mean to say he's guessed right.
Now, stop worrying, my dear," Mike said. "There's nothing to worry about." Then he turned to Richard Pratt and said,
"I'll tell you what, Richard. I think you and I better slip off into the next room and have a little chat."
"I don't want a little chat," Pratt said. "All I want is to see the label on that bottle." He knew he was a winner now. Then this happened. The maid, the tiny erect figure of the maid, was standing beside Richard Pratt, holding something out in her hand.
"I believe these are yours, sir," she said.
Pratt glanced around, saw the pair of thin, horn-rimmed spectacles she held out to him, and for a moment he hesitated.
"Are they? Well, perhaps they are. I don't know."
"Yes, sir. They're yours." She put the spectacles down on the table beside him. Without thanking her, Pratt took them up and slipped them into his top pocket behind the white handkerchief. But the maid didn't go away. She remained standing beside Richard Pratt, and there was something so unusual in her manner that I, for one, found myself watching her with sudden apprehension.
"You left them in Mr. Schofield's study," she said.
Her voice was unnaturally, deliberately polite.
"On top of the green filing cabinet in his study, sir, when you happened to go in there by yourself before dinner."
It took a few moments for the full meaning of her words to penetrate, and in the silence that followed I became aware of Mike and how he was slowly drawing himself up in his chair, and the colour coming to his face, and the eyes opening wide, and the curl of the mouth, and the dangerous little patch of whiteness beginning to spread around the area of the nostrils.
"Now, Michael," his wife said, "keep calm now, Michael, dear, keep calm!"